Last night at Yule Feast, we had a wonderful gathering here with all the lords and ladies in their magnificent clothing, in their velvets and satins and jewels and lace. It was a sumptuous gathering of the social elite of another day. There were a few men of the cloth. There was a wizard and a small but quite ferocious dragon. And there was even a leper in sackcloth and rags. But mostly it was a gathering of the upper crust. When Kim arrived in her barmaid's clothing, she gazed around her and said, "So many lords and ladies and so few peasants." Percentage-wise, she said it's the exact opposite of the actual proportion of rich and poor in medieval society. And that's a great image to have in mind when reading the story of the wise men coming to Jerusalem and then going on to Bethlehem. It's a different millennium and a different part of the world, but it's an agrarian society, a society that is supported mostly through agriculture, and agrarian societies were quite similar in structure and how they functioned throughout the world and throughout the millennia. In those societies, there is a huge peasant class and a very tiny group of elites, and practically nothing else in the middle, non-existent middle class in those days. The peasants, that great bottom layer of the pyramid, raised the crops and built the buildings and dug the ditches and fought the wars and tended the flocks and wove the fabric and transported the goods and paid the taxes and tributes to the king. And they mostly lived in the country, for obvious reasons. They were of low status and low security. They were always at the mercy of uncontrollable forces of politics and economics, the weather, famine, war. They were at the bottom of a very broad pyramid. The elites, on the other hand, lived in the cities, controlled the workings of society. They were the ones who made war, who collected the taxes and tributes, who frequently owned the lands that the peasants farmed, dictated what was to be grown on those lands, whether it was going to be food crops or exportable cash crops. They ate and exported the food and wine and olive oil that the peasants grew. They wore the clothes that the peasants wove and sewed. They conscripted the sons of the peasants when making war on the elites of other nations. In fact, Bob Coote, who was my Old Testament professor in seminary, did not call them the elite. He called them the war-making class. So if you look at someone like Herod, the top of the elite in Jerusalem, he was a person of high status and pretty high security. He was a Jew who ruled Judea at the will of Rome, because Palestine was a Roman province in those days. But as long as things went smoothly and Caesar was satisfied, Herod was in a comfortable position, and he was called the King of the Jews. And he wanted to stay the King of the Jews. So when the wise men came into Jerusalem, these magi, in the Greek New Testament it says magi, which is a word for a court astrologer, really. It's the word that we get magician from, and magic. These were not kings, even though we sing about "We Three Kings of Orient Are." The image of kings coming into Jerusalem is really from Isaiah 60. That passage that Bob read about kings will come to your rising and nations will gather and the camels, all these camels, and they will bring gold and frankincense. That's why we sing about "We Three Kings," is because of what Isaiah said, less than what Matthew said. But these court astrologers were courtiers serving some other king in the east, in Persia. And that class of courtiers, of court, sort of court hangers-on, is an interesting class. They served the elite. They were necessary to the functioning of a court. They were of high status and very low job security. As long as they kept the king happy, they would get the fine house and the luxurious clothes and the sumptuous feasts. If they did not keep the king happy, they were suddenly part of that big peasant class and no longer one of the elite. And part of a class of peasants who probably did not like them because they used to be part of the oppressing class. So there's an important point within all of this. All over the agrarian world, this is how societies functioned. The huge class of peasants, the tiny class of elites running things. So no matter where you were, if you're here, lots of peasants, tiny group of elites. Some other country, lots of peasants, tiny group of elite. Over here, peasants, elite. And these groups of the elite rulers of these countries, or provinces, or fiefdoms, whatever they may be, those elite had more in common with each other, despite the differences in nationality or religious groups or languages or cultures. They had more in common with each other than they had with the peasants they ruled. By far, there was a huge gap in economic status, in worldview, in experience, in expectation of what your life was going to be like. The elite could relate to each other far better than they could relate to their own peasantry. So, here are the Magi, off in Persia. They see the star that says, there's a new king. Time to go and pay him homage. Better go establish a relationship, one elite group to another. Here's a new king. We're going to have to build some ties there so that we can buy each other's goods and not end up making war on each other. So where do you go? Where do these court people go to establish a new relationship with a new king? They go to the big city. They go to Jerusalem to hang out with the people that they know and with whom they can relate and with whom they speak a similar language. They go to Jerusalem, this beautiful walled city in the hills of Judea with its palaces and its temple, and they come into town and they say, so where is this baby born to be the king of the Jews? For we have seen his star at its rising and we come to pay him homage. They're not asking the peasants. They don't talk to the peasants. They're asking the other elite, the people in the know, the people in power. Where is he who was born to be the king of the Jews? So there's one thing I'm not clear about in this story, and I've read different interpretations of it, different conclusions. When the Magi come into Jerusalem and say, where's this new king of the Jews? Did they think that Herod's advisors had already seen the star and had said there's a new king rising and Herod was okay with that? Did Herod have a new son that was just born and the star was for him? Or what was Herod's court thinking about this new star that had risen? Or did the Magi come into town knowing that this news was going to upset Herod and that they somehow wanted him off balance? I'm not quite sure. But whatever their intent was, when this rumor came through the elite grapevine that some new guys were in town saying, where's the new king? Herod panicked. It says Herod was frightened. What does it say? When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. All Jerusalem means the elite, not the peasants. The elite, when you hear about the exile of Israel into Babylon, it was the elite who were picked up and taken into Babylon. The peasants stay where they are. They don't matter in this configuration. It's just kind of, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Whenever whoever's ruling, that gets shuffled around. The peasants still just do what peasants do. They just pay their tribute to somebody else. But the elite in Jerusalem, they cared a lot about this news that someone was coming into town asking about the new king, because their whole way of life was dependent on Herod staying in power. So when it says Herod was frightened and all Jerusalem with him, those are the people up here, the top of the pyramid. And Herod's panic, we were talking about this in the Bible study the other day, Herod's sudden fear, and this fear that rippled out through all of the ruling classes of Jerusalem, was the hinge on which this whole story turns. Herod needs to know if he's about to be out of a job. So he calls his court advisors, his magi, his priests and scribes, to find out what's going on. And the chief priests and the scribes of all the people that it mentions in Matthew, those are the ones who study the Hebrew scriptures, who study the words of the prophets and interpret these prophecies to the king. They are the people who know Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Amos and Hosea and Micah, all of the writings of all of the prophets from hundreds of years before. They've been studying them for centuries. And there are lots of texts that they could have quoted back to Herod, especially if they wanted to calm him down. They could have gone with Isaiah 60, the text that we read this morning. It says, "Lift up your eyes and look around you. They all gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from far away, and your daughters you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and rejoice. Behold, you know, nations shall come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn, and this multitude of camels shall come." Jerusalem, this text says, Jerusalem is going to be the center of the global economy. That's what this star means, and these kings, these wise men coming on their camels, these caravans of goods coming in and caravans of goods going back out again. They could have told Herod, Isaiah says, it's all good. It's all about you. It's all about you and your household. We are back from exile, and things are going back to normal. The city thrives. The flocks in the fields are creating our wealth. The multitude of camels is coming and going. Nations are coming and kings to your rising. See those magi? They're proof that you are the man. Don't worry, no problem. Have another glass of wine. But instead, in Matthew, it says that the chief priests and the scribes, when Herod says, where's this king going to come from? They say, oh, well, it says here in Micah, he's coming from Bethlehem. Because from Bethlehem will come a shepherd who will rule my people. Bethlehem. This rural backwater, 10 miles south of Jerusalem, out in the sticks. It's a peasant village. There was an actual saying in those days, shows up in the Gospels elsewhere, can anything good come out of Bethlehem? It's like Podunk. It is the symbol of a backwater town. But this is what the prophet Micah says, which then is these chief priests and scribes quote to Herod, and that shows up in Matthew's Gospel. But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people Israel, and he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall live secure. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be the one of peace. Probably not what Herod wanted to hear. But that's part of the epiphany that we celebrate on this day, that God has shifted the foundations of power from the city of the elite to the village of the peasants. That's why I chose this artwork for the front of the bulletin. That's a wonderful Latin American liturgical artist. That he shows the peasants coming to worship, the three peasants coming to worship the baby Jesus, bringing corn and bananas and grain. The power is shifting from the city of the elite to the village of the peasants. And the wise men now hearing this, then Herod calls them and says, okay, sounds like it's Bethlehem. Go there, find this baby. And the wise men have a choice. They can stay here and give honor to Herod in his glittering palace, give him the gold and the frankincense of Isaiah 60, and shore up their variable status as best they can. Or should they take the other road, that alternative road, out to Bethlehem, to the countryside, and kneel down, not on the thick carpets and beautiful tiles of Herod's palace, but in the dust and straw of this peasant household, handing their treasures over to a young peasant girl and her laborer husband, people with whom they have nothing in common, except for a vision of a new world that is breaking forth upon them. The Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann In writing about Isaiah 60 and Matthew 2, these Epiphany readings says, "The voice of the prophet Micah, the second reading about this new king arising from Bethlehem, is the voice of a peasant hope for the future, a voice that is not impressed with high towers and great arenas, banks and urban achievements. It anticipates a different future, as yet unaccomplished, that will organize the peasant land in resistance to imperial threat. Micah anticipates a leader who will bring well-being to his people, not by great political ambition, but by attentiveness to the folks on the ground." The narrative of Epiphany is the story of these two human communities, Jerusalem with its great pretensions and Bethlehem with its modest promises. It's pretty amazing, really, to consider the choices that the Magi had to make. Which road would they take? Do they settle for the traditional comforts of the court in Jerusalem, or do they follow God's wild star to the stable in Bethlehem? And an even larger question that they had to face, once you have had that epiphany, what do you do next? Once they follow Herod's instruction to go to Bethlehem and find the child, Herod says, "And once you found him, come back and bring me word so that I too may go and give him homage." Right. So they have seen the child. They have given him the gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And they have to decide now, do we go back to Jerusalem? Do we go back to Herod? If we do, we know what's going to happen. We know what Herod is going to do. But we will be playing our proper role in this social structure. We will be protecting our somewhat risky status. And if we don't, we could be in deep trouble. Deep trouble. They could still play the old power game. They could betray the baby Jesus to the murderous power of Herod. And we know about that murderous power because just a few sentences later, because of the choice that the wise men make not to go back to Herod, he then sends his soldiers to kill all of the babies in Bethlehem. But it says, being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they left for their country by another road. Being warned in a dream. I hesitate to say that the message of this text to us today is to listen to our dreams. That could easily devolve from a sermon into sort of a bad motivational speech. Perhaps a better message to take from this text is that we should listen to God's dream, and that's where epiphanies are born. We should listen to God's dream of a peasant king who shepherds the people, God's dream of swords being beaten into plowshares, and God's dream of justice flowing down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream, and God's dream of forgiveness given and received, God's dream of enemies being loved and peacemakers being called God's own children. The road to the fulfillment of that dream is not the road to Jerusalem. It is not the road back to the way things were before. It is not the road where we hope that things will get back to normal with our power and our palaces. But instead, the road to the fulfillment of the dream that we see in Epiphany is the road to a stable and a manger and a child who is called the Prince of Peace. Amen.